This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Vanity Fair.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
David, we have two interviews to share today. You did both of them. I'm sure this has happened before on our podcast, but it's been a while. And you caught up with two, I think, of some of the most fascinating contenders who we'll be seeing at some of the upcoming televised award shows. Let's start first with your conversation with Alma Poisti, who is the star of the Finnish film Fallen Leaves, and I think one of the most delightful surprises, if not the most delightful surprises, of the Golden Globe nominations. She's in the Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy category. I still haven't seen Fallen Leaves, but I think I'm one of many people who put it right at the top of my list when that nomination happened.
And it is so good. So definitely watch it. I really did not know anything about this movie before I saw it. I'm fairly familiar with the director, and I'd heard of Alma Poisti before, but this movie is such a beautiful, subtle character study, and she is wonderful. So I would count it as the most exciting and surprising Golden Globe nomination of the year.
Do you know what's the huge selling point I keep hearing from people is that it's, what, 80 minutes long, which is something to truly treasure this year.
Yeah, I think 81, so
okay.
But yes, it is not a, demanding three-hour Finnish language film. It is breezy. It is funny. There's, I think, a good element of tragicomedy to this movie. And it's very sweet and it's very honest. It's really about people who meet, who have a lot of baggage and who really connect. And you observe that in a pretty masterful way, I would say, quietly masterful. But it's you feel like you're in really sure hands. And Poisti plays a woman living in Helsinki. She works in a supermarket. She stocks shelves. And she meets this man, and we go from there.
Yeah. I love it when we get to feature, you know, something of a discovery. Not that she hasn't been working for a long time, but maybe a lot of our listeners don't know about this movie or Alma Poisti. So let's meet her in your conversation with the star of Fallen Leaves, Alma Poisti.
Well, Alma, thank you so much for being here. I am a huge fan of this film, Fallen Leaves, and I think everyone that I know who's seen it was absolutely over the moon that you were nominated for a Golden Globe for it.
Well, thank you so much, David, and very nice to talk to you. It's very exciting and surreal times.
I can imagine. I would imagine you were not expecting it. It doesn't happen too often for Finnish films.
No. No, really. It really was the most fantastic surprise. I didn't even understand that that was happening because I just heard someone said that, oh, the film is on the list. The film is on the list for the Golden Globes. I was like, yes, fantastic. But I didn't realize that I was on a list too. And that was that was really crazy. And then we realized later on, because whole of Finland went sort of nuts, that this hasn't happened since the 50s that a Finnish actress has been or actor has been nominated. And it's the first time for a Finnish film, actually. So that's historical.
It's pretty amazing, very deserved. And I have to say, it's pretty exciting to see your name next to like Margot Robbie, Jennifer Lawrence, Natalie Portman. In the best way, you kind of stand out there.
Oh my God, I am so honored. But I love this genre also, that you can have Barbie and Fallen Leaves in the same category. That says a lot about where humor can go, actually.
Yeah, it really does. And I'd love to ask you a little bit about that. And the fact that I think a lot of people don't necessarily know when they say see the poster for this movie or aren't as familiar with your director's work, that this is a comedy. It's a very particular kind of comedy. But yeah, how have you found talking about the movie in that regard and being a part of a movie that is actually very droll, very dry, but very funny?
Yeah, well, Aki Kaurismäki, the director, said that we were going to make a romantic comedy. And, well, it's this sort of deadpan humor. He also said that, so there's going to be one kiss on the cheek, one handshake, and one kiss on the forehead. So it will be full of passion.
true to Kaurismäki form, yes.
True to Kaurismäki. And he has this unique humor that no one can copy. I mean... Mm-hmm. It's really, and it's like a ground force of life. The humor in his films is really what is getting the characters through their day, because they are living quite rough lives. Yes. But then they have this warmth and heart and humanity around them and this humor.
Yes. Yeah, you and your co-star are both very funny in this movie. I'm curious, though, how much in a film like this with a director like that you're playing the comedy. Like, is it something that kind of comes through naturally? Is it something where you're trying things out? Like, how does that look given how dry it is?
Well, Aki has a very particular method. He doesn't want us to rehearse, for one. Mm-hmm. And then he does want to do the movie in one take, or all the scenes in one take.
Right.
So you sort of need to get it right from the start. Mm-hmm. Almost the whole thing is done in one take, actually. And so it's a very high level of concentration, and there's really no room for improvisation. There's definitely room for life, but it's a very minimalistic life. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the humor, you just have to trust it, that it's there and it's in the lines and it's between the lines, and not sort of act it out, because then you probably will destroy the thing that would be funny.
yeah.
So not making a point of it, just sort of riding with it and trusting the audience. He does that a lot. I mean, the movie is quite silent. The Finns are known to be as a shy bunch of people, and we do enjoy our silences. And there are a lot of things happening in those silences where there's a lot of dialogue without words.
Yeah. I mean, did the tone surprise you at all, given that you're really only doing one take? You know, because you're not rehearsing, you probably don't know exactly how it's going to go. And then you only have one chance.
Yeah. Well, usually when you act or you learn to act, you embrace the mistakes. But here you have to somehow dare to succeed. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the opposite. Well, yeah, it was terrifying at first, but then you really start to love it, because you get these very, very precious and honest moments when something happens for the first and only time, and you save all of that for the camera, so you don't wear it down through rehearsing or multiple takes. It becomes extremely precious.
Hmm. You mentioned Kaurismäki's approach to romance, one kiss, etc. But the movie is quite romantic in his way and between you. So how did you find developing that connection, given what you're saying, that sense of preciousness that comes through?
Well, it's a film about love in many forms, I guess. There's friendship, and there's compassion and partnership towards a dog. For example, my character, she finds a stray dog and she takes her in, and it's at the point when she's totally heartbroken. And I think that the dog and Anza, they really save each other at that point. So it's really more than just a cute dog. It's a profound partnership that they have. And then I had such a wonderful collaboration with my co-star Jussi Vatanen, who plays Holappa, and it's this love story where really destiny kicks in to these middle-aged people's lives, but both of them have kind of passed their due dates on the dating market for sure, and they kind of given up on love. And working with Jussi, it was, we really didn't have to work on the chemistry, as you say, because it was already there, and we can just somehow enjoy acting and these scenes, all of these awkward moments where everything is at stake for these poor people, and everything is so fragile, and they kind of fall in love for perhaps the first and the only time in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's quite fragile at that point, and extremely, well, just wonderful to act and to be in the stretch, those awkward moments. Because these people, they're not used to dating, so they kind of know what's expected, to have a dinner together, for example, but so they kind of behave, but but everything is quite clumsy and, yeah.
Yes, it is.
Just fragile, yeah.
Very much so. In the best way, did you find that the awkwardness, the clumsiness was kind of enhanced by the fact that you were going into takes pretty cold? Like, you know, you're figuring it out with him on the fly, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's wonderful when you have so great people you can really trust. I mean, for Jussi, for example, or Aki, he's been doing this for 40 years. So he really knows what he's doing when he throws us in there. And he appreciates actors in the way that we bring our own handwriting to the scene and our own life. So that was very welcomed, even though everything else was extremely exact and clearly envisioned. So the rhythm was very clear. And before the take, we went through a very, what would you could say, a minimalistic rehearsal. And you just, okay, so then you look there, then you walk there and in this, this pace. But that was kind of it. And then you go.
And then you go. The other element of the movie that I wanted to ask you about, and there are a number of really poignant scenes in this regard, is the fact that it's not a very dialogue-heavy movie. And I'm always curious about how actors kind of step into a scene where they really have to hold it without saying anything. Coming into the movie, is that something you were comfortable with? And how did you find it either way in this particular movie?
Well, I guess it takes some courage to just be as pure and honest as you can and let the camera in on that and just being. And the way Aki Kaurismäki trusts the audience, he's giving the audience a lot of silence and faces to project their own needs for the story somehow, not filling it with too much dialogue and explanations. He trusts the intelligence of the audience. But I actually liked that when I found it was sort of meditative, because we were building the frame for hours together with the team, because everyone needs to get it right on that first take. It's the lights, it's the camera, it's the props, everything. And I just sat there on the set and sort of calibrated myself into the scene. And I kind of loved that, because then you really work as an ensemble, not just the cast, but also the whole team. And it's quite a beautiful way of working, and it's a sneaky way of rehearsing.
Yes, exactly. There you go. You made it work. I've seen you talk about being a Finnish actor and growing up in Finland, kind of being under the shadow of Kaurismäki, especially as an actor, for pretty much your whole life. So what is it like to kind of have that in your mind and then step onto a set of his? Like, how did you square those things? I imagine it was pretty exciting.
It was. And it's such a surreal honor to even be asked to be part of his cinematic universe. That was totally unexpected as well. So I've had quite a surreal year with all of these things happening. But yeah, it's right. We've been kind of under his influence for a long time. So as an actor, you kind of know what's expected in terms of his aesthetics and the acting. But so what I did when rehearsal was forbidden, so I rewatched all his movies and sort of tried to tune in to that universe and the tone, not to copy what the actors had done before, but then I thought that maybe Ansa could be somehow a distant cousin to some other character in another movie, to sort of be aware that you're part of a link that through all these films, it's 20 films right by now, so you have to have a connection to the rest of the work somehow. So that was a way of preparing, I guess.
Yeah.
Another sneaky way.
Yes. Do you have a favorite of his?
Oh, there are so many. I do love The Bohemian Life. I think it's
me too.
Such a crazy, wonderful adventure. And well, as in all of his movies, there are these unexpected twists and turns and this humor that just like throws you off and you throws you in. I've heard some stories about how they were making that movie and it came to as a surprise to the actors that it was going to be done in French. And they said, but we don't know French. And he was like, yes, but your actor is not a problem. And, you know, all of these funny adventures surrounding the filmings.
Wow. So, yeah, you really have to be prepared for anything then with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the joy of it, right?
Yeah.
And I saw you made this movie in like 3 weeks?
Yeah, a little more than 20 days.
Wow.
That's how you do it when you get one take, I guess. And Aki says he cuts before he shoots. So he doesn't get any extra material. And you can see he's been producing films for quite a while. So he's very economical about it.
Did you ever have a moment where, knowing how tight of a time frame you were working in, you felt nervous just about getting it done in time, getting your performance calibrated right in time?
Well, I felt I didn't have to worry. That was Aki's worries, really. I mean, I trusted him completely. The way he wanted to do it, then we do it that way because he knows what he's... Well, the way it works.
Yes.
And it did.
It really did. It really did. The sign of a great movie, I guess, is when you make it for 3 weeks and then you spend 6 months talking about it, which you guys have been doing.
Yeah, I've been talking more about this film than I've been actually shooting it. But it's wonderful. It's like it's a privilege to get to travel with it and talking to people and meeting all audiences from different parts of the world and seeing how it really corresponds with people, and they really seem to take it to heart and thank us for giving them a warmer and safer place for 81 minutes, and that it's giving people hope, and it feels it's really a privilege to travel with a film like this in times like these when people really need to feel a little warmth and hope for a while.
Yeah, I was thinking about it in the context of your last film that I'd seen, which premiered in 2020. Tuve, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Tuve. Yes.
Tuve, which I really liked. And that premiered in the height of COVID. And that was kind of a breakout role for you, right?
Yeah, it was my first main part in a feature. So, yeah.
So how did you experience that, especially when it premiered and because it was Finland's Oscar entry, and how did that compare to sort of gearing up for what Fallen Leaves would be when you're going to Cannes and it's a much bigger show?
Well, Tove was wonderful, and it also really did really well, and people found it, and it traveled to lots of countries. But we didn't. We sat at home on Zoom doing interviews. And so these are the things that COVID taught us also to be very grateful for when you actually can travel, when you can get together, you can go to the movies or to the theater and experience things together. And also now for me to be able to travel with the movie and not only the movie traveling, it's something I'm extremely grateful for. It's also meeting the audiences, because when you work with the camera, you don't really meet the audience. But when you're in the theater, then you share the time and the space together. And so as an actress, I kind of miss that connection a lot when I'm filming. So then this is a small or quite big compensation for that, to actually get to meet audiences and talk to people and see how the film lands in people.
Mm. That's another nice thing about this movie, is it's an element of the movie, the beauty of experiencing films in a theater together and that, what the connection that fosters.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I realize that Aki Kaurismäki he's created these concrete spaces for people He's been building bars and restaurants in Helsinki and Karkkila and movie theaters throughout his life, creating festivals, movie festivals. And really, he's done so much also more than the art itself. So it's really in his sort of system to get people together.
I'd love to ask you a little bit about your experience taking this movie around since Cannes, you know, mainly because a lot of the films that premiered there are now kind of big here in the U.S. From around the world, including your film. Have you kind of experienced the journey along with some of these movies, like, you know, Anatomy of a Fall or the, you know, Pot au Feu? Like, how have you observed that being right there with all these films for so many months now?
Well, that's one wonderful part of this job, is that you meet all these wonderful filmmakers and people at the festivals. For example, Anatomy of a Fall, I think it's an absolutely astonishing movie. And Sandra Hüller is such a skilled and wonderful actress. So, yeah. And then when you get to meet these people, it's an honor. And it's so nice to get these concrete connections. And talking about, well, sharing your passion for this work.
Are there any particular like connections or meetings that have stood out to you just in going around all these places?
Well, I got to meet Sandra Hüller in Berlin for the European Film Awards. And that was very, very precious moment just to say hello and thank you. And then I said hello to Greta Gerwig. A couple of months ago, and that was also quite fantastic. Another wonderful movie is La Chimera by Alicia Rovahar. And that's a wonderful movie and such a wonderful director. So there are all of these fantastic people around.
Yeah, I guess what I'm wondering is how it changes maybe your perception of being an actor, because it's such an added element, right? And this is the first time you've done something like this. So how do you feel? I mean, you're not out of it yet, obviously, we're talking today. But, you know, the thought of coming out of it, thinking forward, does it make you feel excited? Like, what's the kind of feeling for you?
Well, I guess it's opening some doors. For sure. I'm getting wonderful offers for work. And it's exciting, these exciting, more international adventures that... Mm-hmm. That are opening. So yeah, I'm very excited about that. And then you realize also when you kind of meet your stars or your heroes that, oh yeah, they're also just humans.
Yes, they're just like
and
you
and me.
And
that's quite a wonderful feeling also to see. Like, they're grounded and real people.
Yeah, exactly. How is there a particular takeaway of this movie that has resonated with you? I think especially in the way it ends, there's this feeling of hope that feels very earned, like you were saying earlier. But that's very true to this director, I think, at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. For me, one thing that stands out is maybe how he's proposing caring and compassion in a very concrete way as a counterforce for cynicism and exploitation and coldness. And then he shows that in so many concrete ways in this movie. And somehow, as long as you have a solidarity and a loyalty towards each other, then you have some power in your life, even if you're otherwise having a rough time. And that's quite beautiful. And it can be friendship, it can be love, it can be towards a dog, it can be, it comes in many forms. But this way of caring is really what I'm taking with me.
As a dog owner, I definitely appreciated all of your scenes with your dog in this film.
Yeah, she's wonderful. Her name is Alma.
I heard that. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful debut. She's really a very professional actor. And she really blew us away with her presence and her rhythm and timing. And
she won an award, right, in Cannes. She won.
She did. Yes, the Palme d'Or, the jury prize.
Yes, the Palme d'Or.
The Palme d'Or.
It,
w-
And it was competitive this year because Anatomy of a Fall also has a very good dog. So she should feel very, very proud, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Competition was fierce. Yeah. And that dog in Anatomy of a Fall is really fantastic.
Yes. So good competition, good win. Is there a scene, and there are a few I could think of, but I'm curious for you, that you just feel particularly proud of, knowing that you had one take that, you know, that you just felt like you got right?
Oh, I try not to be too proud.
Well, or one that maybe went in a direction you didn't expect that you were pleased with.
Well, one wonderful scene was when Anza and Holappa meet for the first time, and when their eyes lock during a serenade by Schubert sung at a karaoke bar, and I did not know you could drag out a gaze like that. Like the way Kaurismäki does that, and it was really enjoyable to do, and somehow world altering for these two characters when destiny just somehow crashes into their lives and gives them this huge opportunity for love, mm-hmm. and something shivers in them both, and they can't. It was very wonderfully written as well. It said that Holappa gets so upset by this look that he has to go away for a smoke. And it really stirs them.
That visual, that gaze is so memorable in the movie. I imagine it felt like really great when you filmed it, but what did it feel like to see that part in the movie particularly versus when you filmed it?
No, it's kind of the same. I'm like, wow, it just goes on and it's everything. Yeah.
So it felt that way when you were filming.
Yeah. Everything was at stake.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's like a magnet. So you just have to look, even though you're so shy that you rather look away, and then you just have to look again. And no, it's a very human moment.
Yeah. I'm starting to understand the power of this one take thing, because it's true that all these human moments that you're describing, it's, you know, you walk in and even if just looking at someone, it's very raw.
Yeah, it is very raw. And as soon as you have to repeat it, there comes this sheer element of fake, a little, because you have to pretend that it didn't happen before and then you have to act it more. That was one thing he said, don't act. That was, well, the only advice he gave us.
And I think my highest compliment would be very little acting here. It feels very, very real.
Well, thank you so much. Whatever the non-acting means.
Yes, exactly. Yes. However Kaurismäki and you guys did it, you did it well.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
And now, David, we're going to hear a conversation with the star of a film that really requires no introduction. America Ferrera is one of the stars of Barbie. And I think the heart of the film in a lot of ways that I think has been coming out, you know, her role in Barbie's, you know, second win awards campaign has been really visible. I think they've been really making an effort to point out that it's her monologue that you really walk out of the theater buzzing about. So I'm imagining you talked about that and probably a lot of other stuff.
We did. America spoke with Rebecca Ford I believe, before the actor's strike about that monologue. So quite a relationship Vanity Fair's had to that, that monologue. But yeah, I was really interested in her perspective on the way that that monologue has been talked about, lived on, become such a symbol of the movie, has been picked apart. You know, it's gotten, I think, played a kind of a meta role almost in terms of what it's about versus the way that it's been received. And she is really game, I think, to talk about it and has thought about it because she put so much into delivering it as best she could.
Yeah, I just, you know, she's someone who's had such a long career. Like, she's been celebrated in, you know, a lot of different smaller ways. And to see her having this platform in a movie that I don't think anybody who made it could have imagined just how huge it was going to be. You know, the cast from The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants was out with her at an event in December. And you're like, yes, that is, we all want to like rally around and celebrate her at this moment.
Yeah, it had been a while since she did any movie at all. And this year she was in both Barbie and Dumb Money, which, you know, obviously didn't make as much of a mark, but was still a nice, meaty role for her to sink her teeth into. She's great. And it's funny how in the over the course of the season, you get a lot of narratives kind of thrown in your face, people whose time has come, people finally getting their moment. And she's someone who has been working really steadily in Hollywood for a long time, from Ugly Betty to Superstore to, of course, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. And yet this does feel like kind of a turning point or something that maybe feels a little bit overdue in terms of the industry taking a step back and really paying attention to her and what she has to offer.
Yeah. Well, let's hear more of what she has to offer. Let's hear your conversation with Barbie star America Ferrera.
Well, America, thank you so much for being here to talk about Barbie, a movie that no one is talking about, you have not talked about at all for the last 6 months.
That's right. Yes. Thank you so much for giving our little movie some airtime.
The little engine that could.
That's right.
That said, it is a movie that we haven't had a success like this in this industry ever. So it is worth celebrating that, I think.
Yeah.
I wanted to start just by asking you how you've experienced this campaign so far. This is the first year in which you had movies out in a while. You also are in Dumb Money, of course. And a campaign like this can be a lot. So how have you experienced it?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I have never been a part of a movie or a project so eagerly anticipated in a way the campaign began, I think, when the world found out Greta Gerwig was making a Barbie movie.
Very true.
And I think that perked a lot of people's attention, right? It was like, whoa, why? And like, what is she going to do with it? And you know, I was in the same boat as everybody else, as like, that sounds kind of weird and interesting. And then, you know, just the addition of all the incredible talent, Margot and then Ryan and then, you know, all the amazing cast and then the kind of, you know, top of class department heads in every realm. It just, I feel like before we even stepped on set, there was a sort of anticipation from the outside world projected onto the movie. And that just built and built and built and built, you know, and then we were traveling the globe before the release, but nobody really knew what the movie was. You know, it was like this fever pitch excitement. I remember getting to Mexico City and 20,000 people had been waiting in the middle of a mall in Mexico City just to look at, you know, Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie. And I was there too, but I have a feeling they weren't really there for me. But it was like, you know, I'd only experienced that kind of energy on presidential campaigns, you know, where it was like people standing around for hours just waiting to like be a part of this cultural moment. And it was huge. And, you know, it was like in the global campaign, we started, you know, we went to Korea and Australia and Mexico and London, and we started getting a sense of like, wow, people are really turning out for this and dressed to the nines. And it really felt like a cultural event. And that was really fun because, like you said, it's, you know, it's been a really long time since movies have been this globally shared moment, right? You know, like we haven't had our Titanic moment, you know, for our generation where people, or, you know, Harry Potter was sort of that. People got dressed up and came out, but they're few and far between. So I think we, you know, felt that energy building. And then the movie, and then the strike hit, right? And then the movie came out. And so for a while, it was like, you know, sitting on your hands all of a sudden, not being able to, not being able to talk about the movie, even though it was out in the world. And finally, people knew what the movie was. Because up until then, you know, they didn't give very much away in terms of the story and the deeper themes and the comedy and the meaning of it. And so, you know, we just kind of had to sit back and watch it impact, you know, make impact with people. And it was cool to read all the articles and think pieces and to see, you know, social media blow up with what was resonating with people. So it's been a wild, wild, wild ride. And I'll just say lastly, because we had the strike, we didn't really get to talk about it, to really talk about what the movie is. So, you know, I, for one, am enjoying getting a second chance at being a part of, you know, the conversation about what the movie means to people.
So were you, I suppose, observing it from afar during the strike? Because, of course, for listeners who don't remember, truly the movie came out and you were on strike. It was at that exact moment, pretty much. And you have this beautiful monologue that you deliver so brilliantly in the movie that was, I would say, the talking point in many ways of the movie. Like, were you reading what people were saying, how it was resonating? I think you could say to a certain extent, you know, debates over it. Like, how did you process all that?
Yeah, I definitely was. I don't generally, like, look for reactions and reviews and that sort of thing. But because it was the only way we could interact with it, I was a bit obsessive about wanting to, like, see how people were responding to it. I mean, and I could see that from, like, people's TikTok videos to, you know, the fun content that people were making just going to see the movie theaters. And I was too chicken to go watch it in a theater. Like, it's very, you know, I think for most people, it's really hard to sit and watch yourself. And I get really scared to sit in a room full of strangers. I'm like, what if they hate it? I wouldn't be able to stand that. But other people, like Greta, went and, like, sat in the back of theaters and watched audiences' reactions. And I'm sure it was, you know, mostly very good, but I was just too scared to do it. So all of that to say, like, I don't usually do this, but I was kind of voracious about reading every think piece about Ken's journey and Gloria's speech and, you know, Barbie and Gloria being shipped on the internet. And are they in love?
I was
eating it up. I really loved seeing how it made an impact and not just in the U.S., you know, globally, seeing how it, like, resonated in China with women on social media in China sort of claiming hot pink back, even though they weren't allowed to wear that because of, you know, very racist, like, skin tone color standards. You know, there were women in China wearing hot pink and reclaiming hot pink as, like, something that they were taking back, even though they were told they weren't allowed to wear it. So it was just really cool to see it resonate in different ways all around the world.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing to watch, I think, for everybody, because, like you said, it does not happen ever, really.
Yeah.
And it's for a really great movie, which is always nice. It doesn't always happen that way either. Going back to the monologue for a moment, I know you said I assume you've watched the movie at least once.
I've seen it 5 times.
Okay. Yeah. So how did it feel to watch that scene, particularly 5 times? I mean, I know you've talked about the prep that went into it, the amount of takes and tries and stuff like that. I'm curious how it landed for you.
Really hard to watch it. I mean, I'd say the first 3 times I watched it, I just held my breath and sort of, like, you know, like squinted and tried to get through listening to my own voice. It was really, really hard at first. I think, like, you know, I don't know, for me, in the first pass of watching anything I'm a part of, it's like, huh, why did they choose that take? And why not that take? And oh, they yeah. went that way. Or why did I do that thing with my face? Or, you know, it's like a lot of internal critic speaking. And it kind of took three watches to really just sit back and enjoy it, you know? And then I think, like, the first time I really enjoyed watching the movie and also felt like I could enjoy my performance, was including the monologue, was at the LA premiere. And it was the first time that we watched it with, it was like an audience of thousands, I think, at the Shrine Theater in LA. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, who's 3.5, was sitting on my lap the whole time. And I loved it. And I loved just having her with me watching the movie. It was her first time in a movie theater. And and that was the first time, because there were so many people reacting and responding to the movie, I could kind of be outside of my own thoughts and soaking in how they were taking it. And when it got to the monologue, maybe it was just because my daughter was like with me and I was sort of trying to see it through her eyes. Like, what is she seeing right now? You know, not that she could understand a word of what I was saying. But I don't know, I was able to take it in a little bit more. And of course it was the premiere, so it's a very friendly audience. And there was a beautiful response of, you know, applause and, you know, audible cheering. And that always feels really good. So, which is why I restrict watching movies I'm in to premieres, because I'm too scared to watch it with unfriendly audiences.
I'm also interested in that particular experience and, you know, being able to spend that much time on a scene, because I'm a big fan of your television work, and I would imagine it's a very different kind of shooting schedule and therefore kind of acting process that you get to go into it. So it may sound like a strange question, but how do you prepare for a movie like Barbie compared to a show like Superstore, where you are having to go a lot quicker?
No, it's a great question. There was a lot of time on Barbie because I was out in London the whole time, but there was a lot of Barbie World stuff that I wasn't a part of. Like the first 30 minutes of the movie, there's no Gloria or Sasha. So I would like work 2 days and then be down 6 or 7 days, you know? And so like the first, I'd say 2/3 of the shoot, I was there and I was in and I was out, and I'd kind of be there even when I didn't need to be there, just to stay in the zone. I went to Barbie dance rehearsals. I learned the Barbie dance just because I like to learn choreography. That's, anyway, too much information.
great information.
But I did feel a sort of like a building up of like energy, you know, and really wanting to get to express what Gloria's journey was. And then on the back third of the shoot, it was like very Gloria and Sasha heavy. And we went to the real world in LA and we shot all that stuff. And then we came back to London. And truly, like, the monologue was one of the last things I shot. And like I said, there was a lot of kind of energy building up to that moment for me. And it's actually a really great question you ask, because, you know, sets do move quickly. And I love being on television sets. I actually love the pace of TV. But there's something about the filming of this scene in particular that felt so much more like a theater process. It felt like a rehearsal process. It felt like really discovering and finding it in the moment, which, if I'm being honest, is my favorite part of what I do as an actress or a director. Like, I love rehearsal. And we really shot this as a 2-day rehearsal. You know, Greta, you know, gave me so much permission to find it and to go to so many places. And so it felt really like a gift as an actor. And even though it was taxing, you know, and it took a lot of energy, it was also very invigorating. And to be in a creative flow where I was finding one thing in one take and then dropping that and going to a totally different place. Like, it's kind of, it felt like being in that sweet pocket of like, oh, I get to just be in this space for a long period of time and play. And it's not always so fluid, you know, as mm-hmm. on set. You kind of get a couple takes in and it's like, well, I don't know. Are you happy? Yeah, I'm happy. Are you happy? Yeah. You know, and with this, it was like we had exhausted every potential way of doing it, I think. And in the end, I was like ready to put it down. And that's not always the case on a filming schedule because you don't always have the luxury of time to like to really like luxuriate and discover in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, like, if you, like what kind of expectation you had coming in, especially when it's, you know, a Greta Gerwig offer, Greta Gerwig movie. And it's a real opportunity, like being able to step into that space in this really rich role. Like, how did that feel coming into it? Did you feel like nervous? Did you feel ready to go?
Yeah, I think that there's always a level of nerves and excitement, particularly when everyone involved is so great and talented, you know? I think that mm-hmm. there's, you know, from doing scenes with Will Ferrell to Kate McKinnon to Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie, like all incredible actors. And it really, I think, in the best case scenario, just makes me want to, you know, step up and play at their level. And that, you know, that's exciting and invigorating. And it's also terrifying at times, you know, and mm-hmm. I think every artist has to find a way to turn their terror into productive energy, you know, and that's part of the process is like, how do you turn however that material or however that group of people activates you, like how to funnel that and put that into the work. And this was an incredibly activating set. Like, again, there was so much anticipation and projection onto the project from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, I think on so many levels, like it was a lot of people's dream jobs, you know? And so everyone comes in with this really heightened energy. And then you're living in a heightened world with heightened colors and heightened, yep. you know, dance numbers. And it's also in a way archetypal, like incredibly archetypal. And my job was to be a human. And my mm-hmm. job was to resist all of the energy that was moving in that direction and ground my character in humanity. I had to represent the human race. You're very welcome. I hope I did you proud.
Thank you.
So there was that too, that feeling of like, oh, I'd love to kind of give in and surrender to this like wave of energy. But also my job was very specific, what I was there to be and do. And that sometimes felt like a push and pull, like I could go and touch into the fun and the hyper energy of it all, but also I had to resist it in a way and stay grounded. And that wasn't always comfortable. And that also yeah. wasn't always like the funnest thing to do.
Yeah. You're delivering that very, you know, serious monologue in front of the Barbie Dreamhouse.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a different kind of thing from what other actors are doing there. But what I love about the movie and your performance is that you sense in Gloria this desire to be a part of the fun. And this and the script, I think, allows her and you to go down that road in a very believable way.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for saying that. I mean, people want to talk about the monologue, and I love that. Wonderful. But there is so much more to Gloria's journey.
Yes,
and I think the monologue only pays off if you really believe that, you know, this is true for this woman, right? And I really loved so many of Gloria's beats. One of my favorite days on set, which was actually 2 days on set, was shooting the car chase. Like, that was so exciting and fun and new for me. And, you know, that kind of action element of, like, she's doing all these insane tricks with this car, but also trying to communicate a lot, you know, of backstory and exposition and create a relationship to Barbie. And I kind of love and thrive as an actor in scenes where there's so much going on, you know, where it's like, okay, I'm driving the car. I'm also connecting to Barbie. I'm also explaining this to my daughter, you know, and that was just really energetic and fun. And I really loved, it was a good one for me in finding the character and finding the mix of like how much of her, you know, her desire to play and get lost in this enchanted world needs to be rooted in like remembering that she is a real woman with, you know, with real life disappointments, because it could easily kind of float away into a realm of like not really feeling or believing that this is a real woman because she's a grown adult who like wished Barbie into the real world. And how real is that, you know? So I thought, you know, it's in the writing and just the little moments that we found when I like pull the car over and Sasha and I are ducking behind the wheel, hiding from the Mattel execs. And I look over and I go, "You're so pretty." And she goes, "Don't look at me." Like those little moments of like, oh, she's a mom who just wants to love her daughter and her daughter doesn't want her. Like, grounding it in like why this woman is so desperate to re-enchant her life and find, you know, kind of unabashed joy because her mean teenage daughter has deprived her of it.
Yeah. You're also a very skilled, very experienced comic actress. And so I was glad that Greta gave you those beats because even among that cast, I was like, oh, America's going to be funny because, you know, you are the superstore ugly Betty actress in that cast.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I mean, it was fun to find that, definitely. Again, because her comedy couldn't be the same as, you know, Ken's or, you know, the Ken's or the Barbies. They're in a totally different tone. So it was like, where is the humor for her? One of my favorite lines that, like, still makes me laugh is, and it made me laugh on the page, too, was, when she goes, Sasha goes, "Mom, you're going to let Barbie take your tween daughter to Barbie Land?" And she's like, "Yes." And you want to know why? Because I never get to do anything. I didn't even get to go on that cruise that I won at your school auction. What did she say? Because I couldn't get the time off and because your dad's allergic to the sun. Was like so funny to me.
Yeah.
Like that her comedy beats, which to me feels so much like Greta's voice, is so rooted in like just what is so true and so sad about this woman's life. So anyway, I had a lot of fun finding the moments where her disappointments could lend themselves to the humor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of Greta, I did want to ask you about something I'd seen that you said just kind of in the lead up to this, which was you said at some point, I stopped expecting to get that phone call, you know, from a director like Greta Gerwig. Mm. And so zooming out a little bit, I'm wondering, like, what it feels like, given that you felt that way and given that you were kind of maybe in that place as an actor to get that call. And then I think it's safe to say to really deliver on this movie.
Yeah, I realized that, like, kind of when you just hear those words or read those words, they sound kind of sad and disempowered, like I was giving up. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that at all. I think it was, you know, I think a lot of us grow up with dreams of being in the entertainment industry, and there's like one version of what success looks like, right? And it's like being whatever, the it person of the moment and being selected by directors and winning awards and kind of being chosen, right? Like a really big element of being an actor is having to be chosen over and over and over again. And you know, the reality for me was that the kinds of roles that I wanted to do, the opportunities I wanted to sort of show different parts of myself, like they just didn't exist. And so, you know, the idea that like Martin Scorsese was going to write a part that spoke to me and everything I am, and also, you know, didn't stick me in the boxes that this industry has kind of traditionally seen me in, whether that's brown girl, sort of your average woman who doesn't meet beauty expectations, sort of these boxes I was put in very early in my career, and which the stories and the characters I played focused on and had to focus on, because that was kind of how my presence in the stories could be justified, because there just wasn't room and roles for someone like me. I just realized, like, the kinds of roles I want to do are not the kinds of roles that historically exist for people like me in this industry. Mm-hmm. So it was actually a pretty empowering thing when I realized I'm going to have to go be a part of creating that. You know, I'm going to have to produce. I'm going to have to be in conversation with writers and directors and other folks about how we create more of those roles. So it became about moving from a passive position of waiting for something to fall out of the sky, which is incredibly disempowering, to like being a maker of those things, and which was incredibly empowering. So you know, when I did get the phone call about Greta and Barbie, it wasn't like I wasn't like sitting there like crying into a bag of Doritos. I was actually in the process of adapting a novel into a screenplay with my screenwriter, because it's the first feature film I'm going to direct. So I was in a really great place, and kind of dropping that expectation that the phone was going to ring with some incredible opportunity actually liberated me in a lot of ways. And so it was all the more unexpected. And, you know, I think that freed me up to sort of do it if I loved it, and only if I loved it. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't looking for this role or this movie or working with Greta to make me feel good enough. You know, it was, is there something for me to do here? Is this a role that compels me, that feels juicy enough, that will allow me to like explore creatively in a way I haven't gotten to? And so, you know, which those are all the best reasons to do something, you know? And so I jumped in and I said yes. And so it kind of, in a crazy way, being in that place, it took so much of the pressure off, and it allowed me to just engage with it creatively and not with all the burden of expectation that you have when you're an actor trying to map out like a career and opportunities that are going to lead to X, Y, and Z, you know?
Yeah. No, I love the way you put that. And I think that's also a real perspective of someone who has been, you know, in this industry for a number of years and who's learned that. I mean, I remember watching you on Ugly Betty, seeing all of the incredible success that came from that. And I would imagine that coming off of something like that, yeah, you kind of face who the industry excludes, what kinds of opportunities are out there. And exactly what you're saying is having to maybe just take a little more ownership.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I don't feel alone in that at all. I mean, this is a, you know, industry where really anyone who's very good at something then gets asked to do that thing over and over and over again. Yep. And of course, as artists, we want to expand, we want to grow, we want to evolve. And so, you know, I certainly don't feel alone in that truth of like, you know, you're going to have to go out and sort of be a little bit more proactive about creating exciting and interesting opportunities. And never mind that I like discovered how much I love directing and how that's become a surprising part of my journey.
Yeah. With a big campaign like what Barbie is, as we've discussed, I often find when I talk to actors that the kind of career convergence happens where there is some reflection. And I saw recently you reuniting with your Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants cast members, for instance. So have you found that at all, a kind of taking stock moment as you are about to embark on this directing journey? You were in this place as you got this movie. Like, has it poised any kind of reflection on your end?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's really a crazy thing to be part of a movie that is so huge and so successful and has broken so many boundaries and broken so many records. You know, it's unequivocally successful. Like, this is the definition of a successful movie.
It's a hit.
And it's a hit, right? And you know, as people, we have all kinds of projections of what success is and what it's going to make you feel, you know? And I think once you're in something that is unequivocally like, oh, this is the thing that I've been chasing. This is the thing that we're all chasing. This was the thing that, you know, 16-year-old America imagined, one day I'll star in a movie and it'll be like the Titanic and it will break records and I'll get nominated for awards. And, you know, like,
yeah.
So that kind of expectation and projection that at least I know for me existed from the outset, it really has to be met with the reality, right? And and it's just always so different in real life, and not bad necessarily, just different, where you go, oh, I'm an actress with a 22-year career. You know, that wasn't enough to like make 10-year-old America drop dead with excitement, you know, that I have this career. But to get to be a part of something like this and really have to think about what is success to me as an individual? What does this have to do with me, how I feel about myself, how I feel about my work, where I want to put my energies, you know, moving forward, what opportunities may or may not come from this? And I think that, you know, it's definitely a moment to stop and take stock. And it feels a little bit like a mirage where, like, you know, for me as a kid, success was this point out there far away that you could like envision and see and move towards. And then once you get there, it's like, wait, where did it all go? You know, like,
yeah.
Where's the thing that's supposed to make me feel this way and that thing that's supposed to take away those feelings? And then you create another fixed point and you move towards that. And then it's like this rediscovery constantly of like what you think something's going to be versus what it actually is. And I have found that what it is a lot more complex and often interesting and can have a lot of good and joy in it if you find it and you look for it. And it can also be disappointing in some way to get what you want, you know? Sometimes getting what you want feels like, huh, okay, well, that happened. Now what, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I appreciate the question. I think it's, if I'm being honest, as you can tell how inarticulately I'm saying this.
Not at all.
It's just a little bit always more complicated than you think it's going to be.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back with our roundtable conversation about what's ahead in awards season on Thursday. Find us in the meantime at Vanity Fair on social media at VF Awards Insider. I'm out there at Katie Rich, and David.
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.